All right. Decisions. You know, Petty, I got to tell you, I have the hardest time coming in and doing the show with that song just because it grabs you, man. And it makes me start marching around and doing, you know, it's a great song. It's just a great song, great band. And welcome to the Michael Slate Show. That's right. I'll just keep on talking about my favorite bands. All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. We have a packed show today. And for the first three quarters of it, we're going to be talking with someone whose work I've been reading and following. And we've spoken to him a couple times on the show. His name is Paul Street. And we're going to be talking about what the hell was going on last week and the accelerated drive to extinction and fascism.
But at the back end of the show, we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the leader of the revolution. Now, I'm going to play two excerpts from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. The first is from a speech itself on the problem and the solution, up against the false paths and dead ends. And the other is from the Q&A, where he speaks about why immigrants come to the U.S., the worldwide refugee crisis, and the rise of fascism in many countries, including the U.S. But right now, we're going to hear from Paul Street.
Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm all right. And I do want to say, you know, it's really a pleasure to have you back on the air. And as I was telling people, you're an author, a journalist, and an activist. And it's not just an author, a journalist, and an activist, but you're actually somebody who pays attention to what's happening in this era, and including, you know, the fact that the slide, or that it's not even a slide anymore, but it's just sort of a steady march towards fascism. And you recently did a piece that I wanted to really talk with you about this accelerated drive to extinction and fascism, about last week and the accelerated drive to extinction and fascism.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and really, as I'm sort of have a laugh here, but it's not a laugh
in a
sort of, it's basically a damn, man, what the hell is going on now? And you have something to talk about that. Let's talk about what's happening.
It's a dark laugh. Mm. Yeah, you know, the other thing in that description to me, I teach history too. I'm in another life. I'm a historian. And I was thinking like a historian before I wrote the piece you're talking about. And I was thinking about, you know, if we do have historians, which is questionable, you know, 50 years out, and they're looking back on this period of time, hey, history does seem to be speeding up in a very dark particular, you know, kind of way. But particularly last week, and even the Friday before the last week when the Senate voted that, yeah, let's not have any witnesses or new evidence of this sham trial. I think that'll be a very pivotal week last week. Of course, you know, I should bite my tongue because I could go over and turn on CNN or MSNBC or whatever and find out that it's some new outrage. It's difficult to keep track of it, frankly. A lot of people say this now. It's like a game of whack-a-mole, kind of keep track of all the madness. We sort of have our heads spinning these days, which I think is sort of part of the point of an ongoing accelerating drift to fascism. A sense of overwhelm and head spinning is kind of what it's about.
But when you look at this, it's you know, this whole thing of these events being critical and the big picture and where this leads you to, this is actually something I think a lot of people, you know, look, I get up every morning, I read the paper, I listen to the news, I read all kinds of things throughout the entire week, and basically, I got to tell you, I wasn't upset, if I wasn't really on the edge of, like, you know, just running out and doing, you know, whatever needs to be done to stop this, because, you know, I would feel really like I was sort of selling out all of humanity, because this is such.
Well, like I said today, and I mean, we can get in some of the details of last week, but, you know, the madness has continued in the week following the one I wrote about. And like I said today on Counterpunch, in any kind of sane society, millions of people upon millions of people would be in the streets right now. And incidentally, Business Insider has recently published a piece. I don't know if you've ever interviewed Jason Stanley, the Yale philosophy professor, the author of the book, How Fascism Works. He's recently been quoted in Business Insider, literally calling it's time for mass protests. He doesn't have faith in the electoral process. It's not shaping up very well. I think the Sanders thing, which is problematic in and of itself, but is a bit of an outside shot, as Michael Bloomberg steps in with the help of corporate media into the center of the electoral arena, literally buying his way oligarchically, plutocratically, the nomination. The electoral path is looking very dim indeed. And anyway, Stanley calls for people on the streets. Imagine that.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were actually talking about getting in touch with him earlier in the week. And, you know, I've had him on a couple of times. And sure. It's very heavy, though, because even as I'm saying this, I'm realizing things have progressed so rapidly. And in a way, like, his book needs to have a little updating because there's the fundamental there. But this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a kind of a rather thin, I mean, it's an interesting book and kind of a philosophical perspective. It's not really how fascism works as a system. It's really, he goes inside the narratives and sort of the linguistics of meta-fascism across broad historical epochs. But that's an evolution in his position over time. I saw him speak, I think it was sometime last year, in Chicago, and I don't recall him talking about people running into the streets. You know, he was still being sort of cautious about that. But he pays attention to real events and as things have developed, and that's where someone, he's sort of a left liberal, right? Maybe mm-hmm. he's a democratic socialist. I don't know. I suppose he's a Sanders guy. That's an interesting thing to hear from him. So indicative of how quick this is moving.
This is one of the things that actually, we really have to pay attention to as I go along here. I don't want to keep just harping at the same point, but it really is, if people aren't really just firing up their pitchforks and everything else, there's a big problem because people are not getting what the hell is going on. And you describe this whole thing as another democratic gift to the most dangerous criminal in history. And I think that's really important for people to talk about because there's a big picture here. There's what's going on. And people are always looking at, you know, you're not seeing, more people were upset about Nixon than they are about this guy, you know, in terms of the Democrats and all this stuff. But the real need for people to understand what the hell is going on and what's so dangerous about the way things are being done.
Well, the phrase "the most dangerous criminal in history" is not mine. I take it from Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky actually, and he explicitly discusses Trump vis-a-vis Hitler. And he goes, you know, most people would automatically say Hitler. And he points out something that I think is true. Now, it's interesting. I've never heard Chomsky actually describe Trump accurately as a fascist. But what Chomsky says, which I think is a problem, but what Chomsky says is that, you know, Hitler wanted to wipe out all the people, you know, Slavs, gay people, obviously the Jewish population of Europe, political radicals and so forth. But he didn't seem to yet have a plan to wipe out all organized life on Earth. That does seem to be the case with Trump. He literally wants to accelerate the process of turning the entire planet, this is my language, into a greenhouse gas chamber. I wish more people would say that, right? To turn the entire planet into a greenhouse gas chamber. He's also tearing up arms control measures that have barely protected us from World War III. And in fact, few people seem to know that he just launched, he asked for the development of and then deployed a new so-called low-yield tactical, really very provocative nuclear weapon called the W-something, the W-62, which is all, has been put on American nuclear submarines patrolling the seas of the planet. And this is really heavy stuff. So there you go. This is really heavy stuff. And, you know, I mean, there's an epic viral infection breaking out and spreading around the world right now. I don't want to get paranoid about it, but it's a big deal. It's called the coronavirus. And Trump has been rolling back Center for Disease Control budget and capacities in the last 3 years and has just rolled out a budget that wipes out, that cuts the CDC budget yet further, thereby raising dire concerns for public health experts in the United States. By the way, it also slashes the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, and rolls back environmental regulations, even as we watched Australia burn, and as we are learning that Antarctica is in fact warming at a much more rapid pace than we knew. And by the way, it also goes after Medicare, takes money out of Medicare and Social Security. And by the way, Trump has recently removed 700,000 deeply disadvantaged adults from food stamps and has gotten the okay from his right-wing Supreme Court to deny basic public benefits to millions and millions of immigrants in the United States. And the assaults just continue on. And of course, we haven't even talked about last week yet.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Paul Street, historian, author, activist, and journalist, about the last couple of weeks and the danger of fascism and extinction.
Yeah, well, let's jump into that. Let's jump into what did happen last week. I don't want to miss out on that one.
Well, what happened last week, and really, it started the week before, the insane open sham trial. It was the Friday before last week, I believe, that the Senate said, yeah, we don't need to hear any new witnesses, and we don't need to hear any new evidence. You know, even as one particular new witness was going around making the rounds of the airwaves with damning evidence that Trump did exactly what he was accused of in the House impeachment trial, Dershowitz, his celebrity joke, personal sham attorney, had essentially argued on the floor of the United States Senate in a sort of open nod to authoritarian fascism. Dershowitz had argued that the president can pretty much do just about anything he wants to do if he feels it's in the interest of his own reelection and therefore good for the country. So, you know, that happened. And, you know, and the standard thing about, well, why don't we take to the streets as well? You know, they've got this impeachment thing going on, which wasn't going anywhere and never was going to go anywhere at the end of the day because of how the Senate is constructed and how overrepresented the most reactionary right-wing parts of the United States are in the U.S. Senate. And because it takes two-thirds of the Senate anyway to remove someone, which has never happened, though it would have happened in the case of Nixon. Well, okay, well, electoral politics. This is the great, the coffin of class consciousness, as I call it, that is the American ballot box, that we just got to, you know, we just got to just wait for some savior on the Democratic side. So then the following Monday, we had this just damn near military-style black op destruction of the Iowa caucus. I was in Iowa. I was in Iowa City Precinct 17 to observe this take place. All these heartfelt, sincere liberals and progressives trekking into their precincts. In my precinct, most of them to vote for Liz Warren and for Bernie Sanders, to caucus for them, I should say. And then the whole thing just gets crashed, among other things, by an app, a ridiculous app that was developed by Clintonite and Obamanite tech wizards. And, you know, the one vital moment of Pete Buttigieg declaring victory on the night with zero precincts reporting and the endless debacle of that went on for days, which is really still going on. We really don't know exactly what happened, thereby robbing the great progressive hope Bernie Sanders of his election night victory speech that he ought to have had. So that happened. That was on Monday. I think historians will find this significant, then that in turn was followed by an openly fascistic State of the Union address by Trump, in which he spent a lot of his time railing against the supposed specter of socialism. And that's a hallmark characteristic of fascists. They're obsessed with socialism, and they falsely conflate everything to their right with socialism. Trump did that throughout his speech. He got the Democrats, the inauthentic opposition party, to leap to their feet to praise Juan Guaido, the neo-fascistic coup toy of Washington and Wall Street in Venezuela. And he offered a presidential medal of freedom to the neo-fascist, arch-racist, talk radio, hate merchant and oligarch Rush Limbaugh. He was in a really fine and chipper mood that night because he knew his actual exoneration was coming the following day, right? The Senate did what we all knew it was going to do with one dissenting Republican vote from Mitt Romney, who was instantly fascist-style, demonized across the right wing and mocked and demonized and hated and all of that. Romney's speech on behalf of removing Trump was actually sort of interesting in a bizarre and intriguing kind of way. Trump then went to the National Prayer Breakfast the next morning, supposed to be a moment of national reconciliation and bipartisan healing and all of that, and literally just mocked Jesus' Sermon on the Mount by using it as an opportunity to make intensely personal partisan assaults on all of his critics. He bragged about his so-called exoneration and all of that. So, you know, that made for a really interesting week, but it wasn't over because the following day, I believe it was, we saw the fascist-style purging of the disloyal. And so not only Lieutenant Vindman, who had the audacity to testify before the House against Trump, but even his twin brother, who didn't testify at all, and also the, I call him insufficiently enthusiastic, insufficiently Sieg Heil, Hail Trump, UE Ambassador Sondland, who had also somewhat unenthusiastically testified before the House. he had to go too, and there were instant rumors that more people were going to be removed. And in fact, there the right-wing media claims that Trump has given the walking orders to 70 National Security Council Obama holdovers, because the opposition party has to be crushed, and everyone that wasn't part of his regime has to be thrown out. And that was a hell of a week. That was an extraordinary week. I probably only touched the surface.
Yeah, I was going to say, because actually, even, you know, and people, I really encourage people to go and find your the pieces that you've been writing about this, the piece you've been writing. And where was it? Tell people where they can actually access your latest piece on this.
You go to Counterpunch. Counterpunch is a fairly well-known Zine on the left. Counterpunch.org. Now, today I have something 5 down and on Counterpunch. If you just click on my name on any essay I do at Counterpunch, this is your truth thing as well, then you will get a list of everything I've
right,
done.
Right.
And so this one would be two pieces back. It's February 11th, about right. last week, and the accelerated drives to extinction and fashion.
Right. And I really, really encourage people to go and read that and read it again, because this is one of the few authors that's actually speaking to the reality of what's happening right now. You can also check my Facebook page for links to all this. All right. It's just a really, I think it's really important for people to read this and be discussing it. Now, let's jump into this a little bit more. We have a little bit of about 10 minutes left.
Sure.
And
yeah.
I want to talk about this, because there's this thing about the, you know, what Trump did around the State of the Union, the specter of evil socialism. The Democrats are part of a radical left. There's a, you know, this thing about the nativism with attacks on immigrants and sanctuary cities, all of this going on. And it demands a response from people, but that response is not happening. Let's talk about those two things.
There's this faith in that's regularly perpetrated across the corporate media, which is a real problem. I got to tell you, trying to organize people, CNN and MSNBC are really, really big problems now as an organizer, as an activist. People are just glued into this stuff. The message again and again and again is that smart adults in the room, elites, are going to fix this, and you really don't have to go out. I mean, their whole job, their whole mission in life is to keep people off the street. That's the job of the Democratic Party, keep people off the street. And for 3 years, they ran with this kind of fake promise of a conspiracy investigation into Russia, that was going to fix things and all of that. And it never had a shot. And then when it seemed dead, they got this new shot of constitutional faith with Ukraine Gate, and that kept us off the streets. Well, okay, that didn't work out. That's not going to happen. Of course, it didn't work out. The Senate's not about to remove Donald Trump. So it's Republican, and it's rural and reactionary. And the whitest parts of the country are ridiculously overrepresented in the Senate. Okay, so now we have the election. And the election cycle in America never stops. It's endless. And it's loaded with money. Bernie's going to save us. Oh, wait, Amy's going to save us. Oh, wait, Pete neoliberal Buttigieg, who I call Alfred E. Winecave, he's going to save us. No. And now supposedly Bloomberg's going to save us. You know, I mean, of all of those, the Bernie's, there's no point in denying that Bernie's the best. There's absolutely no point in denying that at all. There's no point in denying that it would be good to have single-payer health insurance, that it would be good to have free public college, that it would be good to have big green jobs programs. That seems like an existential necessity. But the game is rigged with the role of the money and the role of the media, and it's fascinating and yet disturbing to watch the defaming of Sanders and the red baiting of Sanders, not just by the right wing, but by the so-called left party, the Democrats, the constant, insistent red baiting of Sanders. And that leaves the avenue of what Stanley is now talking about. And that's what other people do. That's what people do in other countries. They take down tyrannical regimes with direct action in the streets. Look what France is doing right now with vis-a-vis Macron. Look what they did in Puerto Rico and other parts of the world. It's just, we think somehow we're above that we don't have, it couldn't happen here. We can never have fascism here. And B, that we don't have to take to the streets like other countries. Well, guess what? Our American exceptionalism has played itself out, and we've been going about as far as we can with believing that stuff. We do, in fact, have to engage in mass organization and direct action beneath and beyond the election cycle. It's not going to save us. There's no Easter Bunny. There's no Santa Claus in the electoral process that's going to make everything okay for us. And at some point, that's got to sink in. I hope it sinks in before Trump refuses to honor the outcome of an election that doesn't go his way. I think people would hit the streets after that, but it might be too late.
Yeah, and that's something to really keep in consideration in people's mind, in your mind. All of us, we have to think about this because, frankly, look, when Trump just recently, when he was giving his speech a month ago or so, there's a point here where people, you would have thought that maybe there would be like 1,000 people, 2,000 people, 5,000 people, whatever. The streets should be filled with people banging their, you know, banging their plates and running down and screaming to get rid of fascism. But they're not. And this is an extremely important point here, is that, you know, there's a response is demanded, but people aren't charging into the streets. And they need to be, because actually the future of the entire planet is what could be at stake.
When he bombs somebody, it seems like in Chicago, after Soleimani, which was insane, the assassination of Soleimani, which was really a bizarre, authoritarian, fascistic moment, the answer was able to join Refuse Fascism and bring people out. But not on the other stuff, not on kids being ripped out of their mother's arms and put in detention camps, not over ecocide, not over the violation of bourgeois, you know, the elementary rule of law. Those things are not doing it yet. You know, it's like I said, this guy's been seeding the narrative to not honor an election count that doesn't go his own way from the very beginning. I hope it doesn't take till that moment before people will finally get it.
Let me ask you one more thing here, because very important. The fascists, actually, it's not just things that are happening sort of like in the realm of the political, you know, doings of all these people and this question of whether people were in the streets leads to actually this point, which I think is really important for people to recognize, that these fascists are actually getting ready for a civil war. You know, you look at what happened in Richmond, 22,000 people, coming together in Richmond, 100,000 Christian fascists in D.C. Think about all those little, you know, whacked out, you know, as people at one point would have like laughed at them, but these
are
no people.
They are fed in doing this by the dear leader himself, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They are absolutely fed in doing this. And he sent out numerous indications that impeachment removal could well spark a civil war, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he's making it clear that he'd be okay with that. It is not that big a leap from saying that about impeachment to saying that about an election, particularly when you've been saying for the last 3 years from day one that you actually won the popular vote, that it was stolen from you in 2016, which is, of course, completely and totally absurd. And in fact, in his speech the other night in New Hampshire before the New Hampshire primary, he made the insane and ridiculous and wild claim that the Democrats in 2016 had brought up busloads of illegal immigrant voters from radical left Massachusetts in 2016, right? Which is just nuts. But the Trump and Volk ate it up and cheered. And they believe this shit. They live in this hermetically sealed propaganda universe, not unlike the Hitler supporters in the 1930s. And it's very dangerous, to say the least. And they are heavily armed, incidentally.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, we are going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
You betcha.
All right. Take care
now.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Paul Street about his latest article about last week, and it's about last week in The Accelerated Drives to Extinction and Fascism. And you can check out his work, as he said earlier, you can check it out on Counterpunch. And it's really, I think it's important for people to keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and think about what the hell is it? What is it that's actually not happening in this society right now?
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
I'm a point of finger and a finger's at you. I know what you did and I know what you do. Flipping that news, got the people confused. Abusing all the rhythm, leaving us the damn blues. Wicked while you're winning, while the rest of us lose. Nobody knowing just who the fuck who. So identify you.
That was Public Enemy with Those Who Know Who. Now we're going to hear the leader of the revolution, Bob Avakian, or BA, on the problem and the solution, up against the false paths and the dead ends, from why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution.
From all this, it stands out very sharply that we live in a grossly lopsided world. A world where a few dozen billionaires have as much wealth as the poorer half of humanity, and a small number of ruling classes in a small number of countries dominate, oppress, and control the destiny of the masses of humanity, with consequences that are already terrible and could, before long, become catastrophic. And in everything that I've been shining a light on regarding the world we live in under the domination of capitalism and imperialism, we are seeing the consequences of a system based on the private appropriation by competing centers of capital of wealth that is socially produced through networks of production involving vast numbers, ultimately billions of people all over the globe, who are forced now to work in conditions and relations of production that exploit and dehumanize them. It is not simply greed that drives these capitalists to constantly seek ways to more ruthlessly exploit people. It is the fact that if they do not do this, or some other capitalists do it more successfully, that is, even more ruthlessly, then they will face the prospect of not just falling behind, but actually going under, eaten up by other capitalist sharks. It is the private appropriation of socially produced wealth and the anarchy, the feverish competition and contention that results from this, which ultimately underlies and drives all the horrors that are concentrated in the five stops and the conditions to which the masses of humanity are continually subjected. The solution is to replace this system of private appropriation with a system where the socially produced wealth is also socially appropriated by a government actually representing the masses of people instead of a class of capitalist exploiters. And this wealth is then utilized on the basis of conscious planning in the interests and for the benefit of the people of society and ultimately the whole world. How this can be done is spelled out in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. This is the fundamental difference between the society and world we have with the system of capitalism and imperialism that we are forced to live under and the world we could have. The bridge between these two worlds is revolution, a real revolution. Let's be honest, this is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk. First, let's return to the crucial question of what revolution really means. At the very beginning of how we can win, this is made very clear. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. Radical means getting to the root, digging up the old system by its roots and replacing it with a fundamentally different system. And what opens the way to doing this is shattering the rule of capitalism over society through defeating and dismantling its institutions, such as the police and armed forces, that violently enforce this system's rule, and then bringing into being new institutions that serve the radical transformation of society and ultimately the world as a whole. How this could be done is something I will speak to in the second part of this talk. Here I want to underline the point that this is completely different than just winning some reforms under this system. Certain government concessions to the fight against injustice, for example, civil rights legislation, DACA, which granted temporary legal status to some immigrants brought here as children, or court decisions establishing the right to abortion and gay marriage. These were hard-fought victories. But the problem is that they are and can only be partial victories, dealing with only some aspects of oppression under this system, but not eliminating the oppression as a whole or the source of this oppression, which is the system itself. And as we are seeing, even where such partial victories are won, so long as this system remains in power, there will be powerful forces who will move to attack and undermine and seek to reverse even these partial gains. It is also very important to understand the difference between the possibility for certain individuals or even a certain section of the oppressed to improve their conditions or to make it under this system, and the reality that for the masses of oppressed people, the only way they can escape their conditions of oppression is by abolishing the system that maintains them in these conditions. Of course, the rulers of this system and their political operatives and media mouthpieces are forever pointing to the success stories of people who have risen from the ranks of the poor and oppressed to become rich and famous, or at least to realize the great American dream of becoming middle class. This is like going to a casino, where by far, most who play are played for suckers and sink deeper into a hole, while every time there is a winner, it is loudly celebrated, often with bells, sirens, and so on, to make people believe that if they just keep playing, they too can become winners. This touches on something of great importance, the relation between individuals and the larger society and world of which they are a part. Everyone, of course, exists as an individual. But at the same time, the larger society and world establishes the conditions within which individuals exist and function and shapes their outlook and values. Even the aspirations and the felt needs of individuals are shaped in this way. To cite a simple example, no one in 1970 felt that they needed to be on their cell phone continually, because cell phones did not yet exist. But once people have them, they have great difficulty doing without them, as we know. Here, a formulation by the founder of communism, Karl Marx, a formulation that has come to be known as the four alls, is very relevant. Marx wrote that the communist revolution requires and involves the abolition of all class distinctions among people, the abolition of all the production relations, the economic relations on which those class distinctions rest, the abolition of all the social relations that correspond to those production relations, and the revolutionizing of all the ideas that correspond to those social relations. Among other important insights that can be gained from what Marx is getting at here is the understanding that while, again, people exist as individuals and their individuality is important and should be given due weight, overall it is the prevailing economic relations and the corresponding social relations and ideas that in a fundamental and overall sense shape individuals and individual aspirations. The divisions among people in a society like this, including the unequal and oppressive divisions between rich and poor, white and non-white, men and women, and so on, are real and objective. Democratic Party politicians keep saying things like, "Trump is dividing us instead of uniting us." But these divisions are not caused by the divisiveness of someone like Trump. Trump makes use of these divisions in pursuit of his fascist agenda. But neither he nor anyone else has caused or could have caused these divisions. They are rooted in the very nature, functioning, and requirements of this system in the way all this has historically evolved. To eliminate these divisions, it is necessary to eliminate this system. From everything that has been said so far, it should be clear why the fundamental change that is needed cannot be brought about by voting. Of course, those who care about and are determined to do something about oppression and injustice are constantly bombarded with the notion that it is crucial to vote for the Democrats because at least they sometimes say they care about this. And this has become all the more intense and insistent with the rise to power of the Trump-Pence fascist regime and its backing by the politicians of the Republican Party, which has itself become a fascist party at its core. It is crucial to vote for the Democrats, they tell us, in order to do something to limit the harm Trump can do. The leaders of the Democratic Party refuse to say that Trump should be removed from office now, and they insist that even talking about that only plays into Trump's hands. But because of the way the electoral system has been set up from the beginning of this country, with the Electoral College instead of direct popular election of the presidents, and small states having as many senators as states with much larger populations, all of which, by the way, was part of the compromise with the slave states, and which represents today the continuing legacy of slavery. And with the way elections for Congress have been manipulated through suppression of the votes of especially black people and Latinos, as well as the gerrymandering of districts, that is structuring them in ways that are geographically distorted, so that people who intend to vote against the Republicans are concentrated in a few voting districts, while those, especially conservative white people, who would vote Republican are spread out through a number of such districts, giving them a greater disproportionate number of congressional representatives. Because of all this, it is far from certain that in the upcoming midterm elections, the Democratic Party will be able to pull off its blue wave to regain a majority in Congress. And what is the approach of the Democrats in attempting to achieve this? To a large degree, it is to run candidates and campaigns they hope will appeal to Trump voters, including candidates who boast of their service in the U.S. military, carrying out bombing raids and other devastation in the Middle East and Afghanistan. The truth is that not only is it necessary to overthrow the system in order to put an end to what is concentrated in the five stops, and the horrific conditions to which the masses of humanity are subjected in a world dominated by this system of capitalism and imperialism. But even short of revolution, even in order to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from further consolidating its rule and more fully implementing its fascist program, it is necessary to rely not on the Democratic Party, but on masses of people, breaking out of the confines of politics as usual and carrying out sustained, nonviolent mass mobilization to drive out this fascist regime. In fact, a major role of the Democratic Party is corralling and domesticating dissent. For example, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when there was a massive outpouring of opposition to that war, the Democratic Party as such was not in a position to co-opt and derail this dissent because, with some exceptions, Democrats in Congress voted for this war. So they utilized the organization Move On as a kind of oppositional force whose main role was to lure people who were alienated by the war and by the Democratic Party's support for the war back into politics as usual, back into the framework and confines that had produced that war in the first place. More recently, the Democratic Party and those aligned with it have done the same thing with regard to the anger and disgust that literally tens of millions feel toward Trump. And in some ways, the Democrats have actually positioned themselves to the right of Trump, especially in their insistence that the basic problem with Trump is that he is undermining America's dominant position in the world, when in reality, the America First actions of the Trump-Pence regime are aimed at increasing that domination in ways that represent a grave threat to humanity. In case there were a need for further evidence of what the Democratic Party is really about, here are two other striking examples. At the Democratic Party convention in 2016, former CIA head Leon Panetta and Marine General John Allen, a former commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, were featured speakers. And when some people at the convention responded by chanting, "No more war," they were met by attempts of the convention officials to silence them, and then they were drowned out by the mainstream of the Democratic Party delegates bellowing, "USA! USA! USA!" And it's just as ugly as that. And let's not forget that when black youth in Baltimore rose up in righteous rebellion after the police murdered Freddie Gray, Barack Obama denounced these youth as thugs. But he never denounced the police who killed Freddie Gray as murdering thugs. I could go on and on. There is more than a mountain of evidence that shows the actual nature and role of the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. But there is an even more basic problem. The truth is that the governing politicians, the owners and operatives of the multi-billion dollar media of various kinds, and others who sit atop the major institutions of this society are the political and cultural representatives of this system. Just listen to them when they talk about the role of the U.S. empire in the world. It is our interests, our military, our allies, and on and on and on. And the deeper truth is that it would be impossible for them to be anything other than representatives and functionaries of this system. This is why even stubborn efforts by well-intentioned people to turn the Democratic Party into a positive force are bound to fail. Once again, we are back to the economic relations and the operation of the economic system, the social relations bound up with this, and how this determines the character of the political system and the dominant culture. If the political system operated in conflict with these underlying relations, the society could not function. For this fundamental reason, political parties, which have a major role and influence in this society, are and could only be ruling class parties, representatives of the ruling capitalist class, instruments of this system of ruthless oppression, administrators and enforcers of a worldwide empire of exploitation and plunder, responsible for massive destruction and devastation of countries and people, and posing a very real and growing threat to the very existence of humanity through environmental destruction or nuclear annihilation.
Next, we're going to hear BA on why immigrants come to the U.S. and the worldwide refugee crisis and the rise of fascism in many countries, including the U.S. This is part of a longer answer to a question about the rise of fascism and struggle in the international communist movement.
Well, I thought you did a good picture, a good job of presenting the bleak picture in the world. The situation in the world is terrible. Okay, let's just be honest. I mean, there are a lot of potential things that are, you know, the potential positive things that do exist in the real world, you know, so to speak. But the situation now is very bad. It's an expression of these oppressive societies, all the ones you mentioned, you know, obviously including the U.S., you know, feeling strains, you know, experiencing strains and certain crises. And you know, to go back to the Laura Ingrams and the Tucker Carlsons and the, you know, the rest of them on you know, the fascists on Fox, you know, there is a real sense in which the world, you know, the world and the countries of, you know, as these people have known them, are, you know, being you know, objectively transformed and to a significant degree torn apart in ways that are, you know, that have brought forward, you know, these fascist forces. You know, the, you know, I talked, you know, at the beginning in part one about all, you know, these five stops and the, for example, the close interconnection between what's happening with the environment and, you know, the immigrant crisis, you know, which is greater than what the, than what's caused by, you know, in the environmental crisis. But, you know, it's a massive phenomenon, people on the move, you know, in huge numbers, you know, I mean, 65 million people is a tremendous number of people to be immigrants and refugees without a home, basically. And, you know, the it is in certain ways, you know, overwhelming or at least challenging the, you know, what has been the existing bourgeois and oppressive societies as they've existed up to now in these countries, you know, the, and, you know, all that is being greatly played on and greatly exaggerated by these fascist forces. But there's some reality to it. You know, my feeling is, you know, the, and my answer to all these people who complain about all the immigrants coming, you know, across the border, many of them illegally, like, say, into the U.S., well, okay, then, give up everything that you, you know, every parasitic benefit that you get from everything that's caused these immigrants to do this in the first place. And then after you've done that, then come back and see if you want to complain about the immigrants. Because this you can't have it both ways. You know, they want to have it both ways, but you can't. You want to have all the plunder and all the destruction and all the disruption and all the upheaval that your system causes and all the exploitation, including of little children all around the world, which wreaks havoc in these countries, and then you want to complain when the people come here. No, you cannot have it both ways, mother. I mean, look at the Congo. Many people don't know much about what's happening in the Congo, but they should. You know, in the past couple of decades in the Congo, more than 5 million people have died in these internecine, you know, conflicts within the Congo. And you could sit there and say, "Oh, another shithole country. Look what the people are doing to each other." But just as what's happening in the inner cities among the black and brown people and the youth in particular here, on a much more massive scale, what's happening in a place like the Congo is directly attributable to what the imperialist system has done there over more than 100 years. I mean, I'll get back to more directly to what you were raising, but this is part of the world picture, too, that's very important. I mean, do you know, for example, how many people know? I sometimes like to pose these questions. You go on a college campus, and you ask people who are graduate students and professors, for example, what percentage of people would know the answer to this question? Under the rule of Leopold, King Leopold of Belgium, who ran the Congo at the end of the 19th century and into the next, you know, as a personal preserve, out of the 20 million people or so who lived in the Congo during those times, what percentage were killed under the rule of Leopold? Somewhere between 7 and 10 of the 20 million, almost a half of the population. Almost nobody knows about this. Think about that. They were put to work under the most horrific conditions, mining rubber and other things, and if they didn't meet the quotas or in some other way they were considered a problem, they had their hands cut off if they weren't killed. This is what, you know, the great enlightened Western imperialism was doing in this one country. And then, finally, after World War II, when there was an independence struggle in the Congo, and you got Patrice Lumumba came forward as a popular nationalist leader, and became the leader of the Congo, what happened? The U.S. imperialists moved to get rid of Lumumba. The CIA and the rest of them worked to get him captured by opposing forces that were their puppets, basically, and he was assassinated. And what came out of all that? Mobutu, who was kept in power by the U.S. for 4 decades, plundering the country and as a puppet of the U.S. for 4 decades, and subjecting the massive people there to terrible conditions. And this is why the Congo is such a mess now. And millions more people are dying. So don't f***ing complain to me about immigrants coming across the border illegally, okay? Just shut the f*** up about immigrants coming across the border illegally. Look what you have done to the people in the world. And you have the nerve to complain about people coming here trying to get a job so they can feed their family, and calling them rapists and murderers and so on. But there are a lot of strains objectively on all these countries that you mentioned. Isn't it wonderful? Look, the Soviet Union was no good for decades. It was a capitalist, in fact, even when it was socialist in name, and it was social imperialist from the mid-50s on. In other words, socialist in name, but imperialist in reality. But isn't it wonderful that finally, all these Eastern European countries have been freed from the domination of the Soviet Union? Aren't wonderful things happening under the rule of these bourgeoisies in all these countries, like Hungary and these other places, or Poland, and all, fascists rising to power, essentially? And this is what's happening in response to these great changes that are taking place in the world, including the immigrant crisis, is contributing to this. It's a fascist response to the immigrant crisis, as well as other factors. A revolutionary response would be to absorb massive people coming and make them become part of the positive force transforming the society. But the imperialists can't do that, and the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, and the capitalist system can't do that. So they both exploit them, or super exploit them in intense exploitation, and particularly the fascist forces within the ruling circles seize on this to build up a whole fascist backlash against these immigrants who were there because of the havoc that's been wreaked on their country, on their own countries, fundamentally because of the workings of imperialism in terms of the effect on the environment, as well as the wars and the general disruption. I cited the example of NAFTA and what happened there, but you could go, many countries, and back in 2003, I cited the example of, in a talk, revolution talk back then, I cited the example of Jamaica and how many farmers there were ruined by the subsidizing of milk from the U.S., which, and the same thing happened in Haiti. You can go on revcom.us and read about Haiti and how the agricultural economy of the peasants in Haiti was ruined by the penetration and dominance of the U.S. and the particular policies that were created there. So again and again and again, this is what's causing, both this tremendous upheaval and chaos in the world and in countries throughout the world. And it's also, what is giving rise, or a big factor giving rise, to these fascist movements that you're talking about.
That was Bob Avakian on Why Immigrants Come to the U.S., the Worldwide Refugee Crisis, and the Rise of Fascism in Many Countries, including the U.S. Now, this is part of a longer answer to a question about the rise of fascism and struggle in the international communist movement, following the talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. That brings us to the end of yet another show, but before I go, I'd like to read an announcement from Refuse Fascism. Donald Trump said, "I am, I guess, the chief law enforcement officer of the country." If this concerns you, good news. You've got a pulse. Get organized to drive this regime from power before it becomes too late. There are meetings in 12 different cities on Sunday, February 23rd, and you can find the time and location on the Refuse Fascism Facebook page, @RefuseFascism, or you can participate via FB Live. Now I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with another version of Not In Our Name. Talk to you again next week.
I'm crushing the beat. Later for that, our government is leading us off track like Broadway shows go for a second act. That's absurd. One step away from the seventh sign. Your imperialist mind destroying God's design. Father like son in one race up begun instead of uniting the world like the colors of Benetton. One
mark of the beast. May not wear one. New world order taking over. May not care, son. Illuminati not affecting me. I give my soul up to John. Let the maggots have the rest of me. So you can keep on stressing me and arresting me. No matter how you try, you bastards never get the best of me. Sun rises in the east, so you'll always be the west of me. This is who knew and not testing me.
Raise your hands up, raise your hands up, raise your voice up, not in our name. Raise your hands up, raise your hands up, raise your voice up, not in our name. Raise your hands up, raise your hands up, raise your voice up, not in our name.
Uncle Sam, fighting wars to free the land. Tony Bland, G-Dub, Minaj, and all scams. Gives birth to 9 months, 9 wars for more than 9 armies, 9 militias, 9 million men. Then Ashcroft wants my regiment detained in camps. For terrorist words on cells and through the amps. COINTEL, Colin Powell, Claude DePort, teach the kids. First casualty of war is true faction was relative.
War's the Alpha Omega. Arm, leg, arm, head, a shoe, a leg, bar, a leg, from Salon. I'll do more, I was spawned from the root of a law. And I teach peace to the streets, Alpha to Quran. I was born with a dove in my mouth and hand on the wall. I'm the sixth ring of Mordor. Sixth sense of marksmen, archmen, and wizard. Wall steady my aim and smite the sword of Goliath, but not in our name.
Raise your hands up, raise your hands up, raise your voice up, not in our name.